Michelle Obama's book, Becoming.
Oh, I literally just finished that. I gave it a review on Goodreads. Add me on Goodreads, anyone. I thought it was amazing.
You got to provide your name on Goodreads.
Oh, it's just my Facebook account. So if you find me on Facebook, just link it up. Okay. I think that book is a 5 out of 5 on its own, but it becomes one of the best books in the world if you read it alongside Barack Obama's book, A Promised Land.
Right, yeah.
Because you get that double perspective of the exact same events and you have the same milestones throughout both their lives, but completely different perspectives.
I'm also just really enjoying her narration of it. Because I think that adds such a unique element to it, because obviously the way she's written it is the way that she talks and that she expresses things. So,
what speed are you listening to her ramble on?
I am a 2x person.
Two times?
But I know, but...
Hello, my name is Michelle Obama.
She talks so fast though.
So how do we want to start?
Welcome.
A little jingle?
Let's do some recording.
This is pretty interesting, isn't it?
With the aim assess.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting.
Test 1, 2.
Aim assess.
3.
Hey, Satch.
Anyway.
So this is the first time I'm reading this script for this intro. So let's see how we go.
What a week it's been.
It's crazy to think that we have had 2 weekends without AMSS events. Who are we?
Who am I? That's one secret I'll never tell. XOXO, AMSS.
Oh my God.
Anyways.
Are you doing well?
I'm good.
How are your energy levels, your mania levels at the moment?
They're increasing the more I read this script.
Yeah, I mean...
Because I think I was very manic when I was writing some of this stuff.
I think a good strategy for us to increase our energy levels during this podcast is actually just change the font to like Indie Flower and then highlight it.
What the heck?
There we go.
That's so hard to read.
Okay. Don't worry. What do we have on the agenda for today?
We first will catch up with the AMSS as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got Rome with the AMSS, Feet Hui, and the Jazz Night Band, which we will now reveal, one of them.
Yeah, one of the bands. So I play in a band called Citrus Buzz. We've been playing for 4 years for Jazz Nights. I kind of get mixed up with the old one. But we played a gig last night, a wedding for a couple ex-medical students, and it was great fun, and we practiced our set for you guys. So you're going to have a great time next week when we bring all our energy on stage.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I'm so keen to hear that, Rome. And then we've got our Ed Corner. Drum roll, please. Insert drum roll.
Oh.
We've got a very special guest here with us, Dr. Simon Cousins.
For those who don't know, Simon Cousins is currently a doctor, but he was one of the biggest legends of the medical school.
Absolute legend.
Ever. I reckon ever.
Yeah, 100%.
President, VPE.
Yep.
Patrons plate winner. Just did enormous
All-round
things.
Legend.
Not to mention he did president in his 5th year.
Yeah. No idea how he did it, but that's going to be our very special segment for today for Ed Corner.
Anyway, let's get on to it. What's on this week? It's a busy week.
Well... Tomorrow, we've got our second committee meeting for the year. 29th of March is tomorrow, by the way, for anybody listening at other times. And it's going to be heaps of fun. Everyone come along. And committee members, please bring a friend. And we'll have talks on MedCamp and PresCag. And, of course, Jazz Night, which is coming up as well.
Yeah, shout out to Kasusha for all the work she does. That's sick. So, also this week, 3 fully packed days of MedReview audition. Sorry, Shrek review auditions Tuesday to Thursday. Super exciting. So I believe people are doing, well, I should know this because I'm auditioning as well.
Yeah.
2 songs, a rap and an excerpt as well. And if you're doing dance, you do a dance. So
Yep. If
you hear a lot of shouting/shrieking upstairs in the HMS, that's what's going
that
on.
That is what's Tuesday going on. Thursday. But shout out to Sophie, Scott, Sean, Belinda and Stevie. It's sure to be an incredible few days. And the actual MedReview is September 10th and 11th.
Mm.
But they're going to be lucky enough to see all of the talent that's going to be on stage then. So,
have you ever noticed that 4 of their names starts with S and it's just Belinda with a B?
Just Belinda.
B-S-S-S-S. And then we have Jazz Night. When's that?
It's on the 10th of April, Saturday. Freaking 700 tickets.
Holy
sold out
moly.
In 6 hours.
What an insane process trying to get a ticket for that.
Oh, it was, my God.
I can't imagine the stress you guys were under, but it really hyped it up for everyone else, I think, seeing, you know, the website crash because people were so keen on getting this ticket.
Yeah, it was crazy. And it's going to be such an incredible night. I am so excited for Jazz Night. I love Jazz Night. All but right. That brings us to
Rome.
Rome with the Amos S.
Yeah, so just to preface what you're going to hear, we're going to put in a couple snippets of us playing a lighter jazz song, not any of the bangers that you'll hear towards the end of the night. And then we'll have a chat to both Scott and Alec, who are in the Citrus Buzz band. So see you on the other side.
Hey guys, it's we, Rome with the AMSS. I'm here, Citrus Buzz. I'm part of Citrus Buzz. But I'm going to talk to Scott right now about Jazz Night and what we can expect from the band.
All right, hello. Look, we're actually out here doing a gig ourselves. All right, we've got some good, really good stuff lined up. So you better be out there. Bring your legs on the D floor. It's going to be a great time.
Now, Scott, we were a bit disappointed before the restrictions changed because, you know, 50 people in the D floor. But now it's free game. Fair game. Are you excited?
Very excited. You guys better bring as many people as possible, man. We want to see a flood of human beings out there. We're going to make up for everything we lost last year.
Yeah. All right. Any songs that you look forward to playing, Alec?
I think Dancing in the Moonlight is always a favourite for the crowd.
It is. How many choruses do we play in Dancing in the Moonlight in a row?
At least 18.
At least 18, yeah, I agree.
18 sounds good. All right, let's get out there.
We're back.
Today's a special day, Satch. We have a big dog, woof, huge dog, giant dog.
Insert bark noise.
In the house.
Everybody give it up for Simon Cousins. Wait, Dr. Simon Cousins. Woo. Insert clap noise.
Who are you, Simon?
Oh, who am I? my name's Simon. I'm a psychiatry registrar, currently working at the Women's and Kids. I was graduated in 2018 from the wonderful University of Adelaide. Also in sort of probably much greater accomplishment, has recently had a kid, little Magnus.
Yay! Shout out to Magnus.
Shout out Magnus.
So if there's any errors or inconsistencies in information I give you today, it's purely due to sleep deprivation. Please don't tell the college how incompetent I am.
What will you be talking about just to let our listeners know what we're
talking. Oh, that's probably a good start. So being a psychiatry registrar, I'm going to talk a bit about psychiatry. And I guess the topic that is probably broadly covered most in the curriculum is depression. And I guess starting with the second year depression case. So we'll talk a bit about depression broadly, and then sort of, I guess, towards the end, give a bit of context and differentials that I guess apply more to fourth year and sixth year students.
Great. And just for a bit of context, we sort of spoke about it before before you got here, actually, but you're quite new to the AMSS, aren't you?
You know, look, I've dabbled a little bit with the AMSS here and there.
AMSS adjacent, if you
will. Yeah, if you will. I spent a bit of time with the AMSS. My work was with Team Ed, so I did lots of stuff with them, and then had the privilege of being on two executives. As VPE and president in 2016 and 2017, respectively.
We'll get started with the Ed. Jingle and see you on the other side.
Aww.
What's the teaching on this cast?
Things you didn't learn in the past.
Pass them up to a real doctor.
We forgot to invite a real doctor.
It's probably because neither one of us asked.
We should probably actually get someone to fact check all this. It's a good rhyme, though.
Disclaimer time. We're students just like you. The AMSS does not take responsibility for the educational advice provided in this podcast. Please do your own reading and learning for the topics that we discuss. Thank you and enjoy Ed Corner.
Hello, we're back.
We're back. This right. Ed Corner, as we mentioned, going to be aimed at the second years on their post-MI depression case, as well as fourth years who are on psych, as well as anyone else for revision or interest. Yay, psych. Simo, can you tell us a little bit about Pathways into Psych?
Sure. So, I mean, I was very lucky in that I jumped into training straight after my internship. But obviously you can apply at any point realistically in your career, like other training programs. There's generally a process, which is sort of written application, CV, interview. And then if you're lucky enough to be selected, there's a, it's a 5-year training program, and which sort of is 3 years of basic training and then 2 years either sort of completing adult psychiatry and general psychiatry or doing an advanced certificate.
Cool.
Yeah. So you do, you know, much like you do through medical school, you do placements to sort of complete different sections of your training. There's a few exams along the way, a big psychotherapy case, and a few other assessments here and there. And then you know, come out of it as a fully fledged psychiatrist.
Nice. You having fun?
Yeah, definitely. Certainly, you know, like anything, has its challenges, but I'm very, very grateful to have made that next step in my career and certainly have enjoyed it and learned a lot.
Thanks for letting us know.
Yeah, thanks so much. We're now going to do the inaugural ceremonial torch passing. We're going to pass the lead mic to Simo. Take it away.
Marvelous, thank you. I guess I'd like to start by just saying that obviously we're going to be talking about some tough things for people in that we're talking a lot about depression. We'll talk a bit about suicide later on as we go along. If any of that brings up anything for you, you can contact Lifeline 13 11 14. There's lots of great resources through the university itself. In university counselling, UniHealth has a great group of GPs there. And you can also access help through Doctors Health SA, who provide fully bulk billed long consults for doctors and medical students. They're based in Hutt Street, and I think most information is probably on the AMSS website somewhere, or you can get it through the university itself. So depression is quite common, affects a lot of people. The sort of yearly prevalence of a major depressive disorder is 6% in the Australian population. There's a lifetime risk of about 11 to 15%. In primary care, so in the GP setting, 1 in 10 patients present with depressive symptoms. In many instances, the first episode of depression is sort of between adolescence and mid-40s, and 40% sort of present around the age of 20. Average onset is in mid-20s, and there's a sort of ratio that's skewed a bit towards females in 2 to 1. So we're going to talk a bit about major depressive disorder in the context of the year 2 MI case. And I guess the first thing that I guess want to frame is that there's a difference between depression as a symptom and depression as a clinical entity, and what we sort of call major depressive disorder. So I guess it's important to consider in anyone that's presenting with symptoms of depression, what's in the normal range of emotions and appropriate experiences, and what's not, and when is that pathological and something we need to treat. So obviously anyone that has a major illness or sort of major life event like a heart attack would feel a lot of things. It's quite stressful, it'd be quite emotional, it'd be easy to feel quite sad. But I guess when that becomes pathological is when it affects someone's functioning, and when it's so severe that, you know, it doesn't go away, it's not amenable to sort of the usual recovery that would entail with that illness. So whilst I know that's the sort of the frame of the CBL case, I sort of want to frame another case to talk about, and we'll sort of dabble in and out of it as we go along.
Okay,
so as a 28-year-old man who works as an accountant and he's studying an MBA part-time at university, recently had his hours reduced in the context of COVID. He's come to you feeling depressed and increasingly stressed at work. Came to see you at the behest of his girlfriend of 4 years, who's a bit worried about him. So I'm starting to think about what more of a history you need from this man to try to work out, again, is he someone that's just a bit stressed and a bit tired because he's got a lot happening in life, or is he someone that has a depressive illness that you need to consider treating? So one of the acronyms or mnemonics that people commonly use is DIG SPACES, which sort of neatly covers a lot of the DSM criteria for depression. So I guess Hui and Sash, can you tell me some of those symptoms?
Let's back and forth it.
Yeah, yeah. Love it. All right, you go.
I'll start. D for depressed mood, the most common and easy thing for us to kind of think about when we think about depression.
Yeah, and in the elderly, sometimes that can show as hopelessness as well. Again, loss of interest being the second. And in DIG spaces, you're looking at the first two in particular needing one of two.
Mm-hmm. The G in DIG stands for guilt. We also look at other kind of emotions as well, like worthlessness as well.
Yeah. And S for sleep.
P for psychomotor. And so this is something that when I was, I'm still in med school, obviously, but during med school, I didn't really understand or appreciate what this means. So do you mind running through what psychomotor actually means in this case?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, you're sort of looking at, in a way, behavioral activation and sort of the normal expected movements that someone does. So, and in depression, the common pathology that you see is someone has psychomotor retardation. So they're not moving as smoothly or as quickly as someone normally would. They're sort of lethargic in all of their movements. And in sort of quite severe cases, then they can be catatonic. So they're sort of really not moving at all.
Yeah.
So A.
Appetite and or weight loss and weight changes.
C for cognition or concentration.
E for energy, and again, energy loss.
And S, the last one, really important not to miss this, is to screen for suicidal thoughts, ideation, plans, and everything around that.
Perfect. And I think there's a really good acronym for everyone to learn and to use. And you can, you know, literally use it as a checklist when you're taking a history from someone, whether that's now in your clinical skills or when you eventually graduate in ED. It's, you know, it's basic, it's simple, but it means you'll get all of those major symptoms and have a good basic understanding of the experience of the person, and then be able to differentiate whether this is meeting criteria for depression or not. So the summary, and I think the point that was made, was that the D&I are important. So you need one of depression or anhedonia to meet the criteria for major depressive disorder.
With anhedonia meaning?
So loss of interest. Mm. And I guess that, like, again, we're looking at the severity. It's not someone that's just a bit ambivalent about things. Like, the things they used to enjoy quite thoroughly now no longer are enjoyable for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if they had to Marie Kondo their life, they'd want to get rid of everything. Nothing is bringing them joy. The summary of that is that, in essence, major depressive disorder by DSM criteria is depression and or anhedonia and negative cognition, so thoughts of guilt, hopelessness, low self-worth, suicidal ideation, neurovegetative dysfunction, so things like poor sleep, loss of appetite or increased appetite, loss or gain of weight, reduced libido, reduced energy, reduced motivation, and socio-occupational dysfunction, so they're not able to do what they normally would do, whether that's study, work, engage with family or in social settings. There's impairment there. So if you ask a few more of these questions, you get a bit more information from this man, you find out that he reduced his work hours about 6 months ago, and for about the last 4 months he's been feeling quite low in his mood, hasn't really been going out or engaging with his friends as much. He's had quite a lot of difficulty keeping up with his MBA, and he's starting to fall behind. He, you know, tries to make up the work, but he's really having trouble, has to watch lectures multiple times, has submitted assignments multiple times and is really struggling. You ask about his sleep, and he's got early insomnia, so he has difficulty falling asleep. And then he wakes up sort of really early in the morning, every morning, regardless of whether, you know, he's set an alarm or he actually needs to, and then he can't get back to sleep after that. He has sort of increasing sort of irritability, and it's causing a bit of friction in his relationship. He's not really eating as much as he normally would. He sort of snacks, misses meals, and has gained a bit of weight. So you can see that starts to form a picture of someone that isn't just a bit stressed and struggling, but is probably sort of ticking some of those boxes in the DIG spaces and DSM criteria.
Simo,
yeah.
You mentioned this 4 months of low mood. Can you talk us through the timelines that you're sort of looking at with the depressive episode
things like that? I guess DSM and other sort of diagnostic criteria do focus a little bit on timelines. And I guess the thing to, I guess, caveat is that they're not entirely prescriptive, and they're very much a guide, and the DSM as a whole is more of a research tool than necessarily a, you know, exact diagnostic textbook, but they do give us a good guide as to severity. And so, you know, someone that's just had a bit of low mood for a couple of weeks or particularly around the event may not have, you know, the severity of depression that we're sort of seeing here. And in the DSM, 2 weeks is the cutoff for sort of ticking the box for a major depressive disorder. But there's other, I guess, other disorders, including adjustment disorder, that have similar time periods or are focused around stressful events rather than sort of having that degree of severity. And we'll talk a little bit about that later on. But 2 weeks is the official DSM cutoff. So this man's definitely meeting that.
Yeah.
So I guess talking a bit outside of the DSM, and we don't have time for me to sort of cover the breadth of different concepts and theories around depression, and there's certainly a few of them.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to touch on one or two. And I guess the framework I'm going to use is the broad framework that the four tiers will start to be familiar with in the biopsychosocial model of psychiatry. Sorry. So I'll talk a little bit about sort of psychological theories, a bit about the biological theories around depression, and sort of can try and connect some of those dots there. So psychologically, the main one I want to talk about is Aaron Beck, who's sort of the father of CBT and the cognitive theory of depression. So he theorized that the persistence of depression is a consequence of, I guess, negative thinking. And he described a triad of negative cognitions encompassing the self, world, and future. this then formed negative self schemas. So I guess, you know, a conceptualization of oneself as negative, and then errors in logic based on that schema. I guess the extension from that and sort of the behavioral component was the theory of learned helplessness. So people who can't escape this or negative thinking or negative life events and then use this negative thinking to influence how they make decisions and think about their life, get in this sort of pattern of futility. And so combining the two, you sort of get this idea that the persistence of mental illness is a result of maladaptive behaviors and continuing errors in cognition, which are then reinforcing. So you think about things negatively, things start to happen negatively, you then think about them negatively, and all of a sudden your entire world is very negative. You can't sort of think that anything is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you alluded to CBT before being cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah.
Is that aimed at kind of dissecting or stopping this process?
Yeah, so essentially the idea of CBT is acknowledging that these cognitions or thoughts exist that are driving that depression.
Mm-hmm.
It's encouraging the individual to, I guess, take a step back, analyze those thoughts and change how they're thinking about those things. So I guess a simple example, someone that is like, well, you know, if we take this man, so he's like, well, I've reduced my hours at work. It must be because I'm not a good worker. They don't value me at all. And now because of that, I'm going to be destitute. My girlfriend's going to leave me and it's all going to come tumbling down. And sort of looking at and dissecting that, going back to the start and saying, well, are there other reasons that maybe you lost your job? Is it just because the business is downsized because of COVID? Are you actually, you know, what makes you think you're a negative worker? There's any evidence behind that? And sort of getting them to challenge that process of negative thinking.
Okay.
When like, would you say it's sort of creature of habit, but working against us being
And like we know that, you know, for whatever reason, our brain is geared to remember negative things a lot more easier and with a lot more, intensity than it does remember positive things. Mm. So it's about sort of trying to work around that, and therefore sort of get out of that slump and that sort of cycle of negative thinking.
Yeah.
So in addition to these psychological theories that, you know, there's growing biological evidence for depression, we certainly know that all mental illness has some degree of genetic link to it. In depression, a lot of the information we sort of theorize has come about less through sort of diagnostic studies or biomarkers because we don't have them, but a lot of it's about what treatments work. There is some fMRI studies that have been done to look at areas of the brain that light up or don't light up when people are depressed. And I guess the other element just comes from what we know about the general function of the brain and therefore attributing pathology to that. So the area of the brain that tends to be focused on, I think, is a core part of the anatomy in the year two case is the limbic system. So
yes,
everyone's favorite. I mean, back in when I went through it, this was the first bit of neuroanatomy you had. So you had sort of, you had no idea what the rest of the brain was. And it's just like, learn the limbic system.
It's a rough jump into the brain.
Yeah, I know.
But I won't go into it because certainly it's not something that I've even fully got my head around 2 years into psychiatry training. But there's four main functions.
Home is where the ho-ha is.
That's it. Home is where the ho-ha is. So what are the four functions of the limbic system that are garnered by that mnemonic?
Yeah, so the functions are garnered by home, H being homeostasis, so looking after the natural and routine processes of the body. O is for olfaction, as in smelling, M for memory, and E for emotions.
Yeah.
And they're anatomically close to each other within the limbic system. Yeah. That's what we care about.
So I always found the olfaction a bit strange, but I guess, you know, theory is that memory and smell are quite linked, and that makes sense, but it doesn't, it sort of is a little bit of the odd one out when you're talking about, you know, psychopathology and depression. Obviously, you know, memory, emotions, homeostasis is all sort of linked up, but the smell bit's a bit on the edge.
Yeah, yeah.
Nonetheless, and then sort of, again, won't go into all of the bits and pieces of the limbic system, but the one that we like to focus on in sort of depression, and I guess in other psychopathology, is the amygdala, little almond of emotions. And that tends to be where we associate a lot of the pathology for depression and other mental illnesses. There are two main pathways that we'll just quickly cover that are, you know, involved in the limbic system and, you know, considered around in depression and other psychopathologies. Do you know what those are?
I've gotten rid of them here. So I'll start with the first one, corticolimbic.
Yep.
And this one covers serotonin. So serotonin being the one that I associate more with depression compared to dopamine.
Yep.
With then the second pathway being the mesolimbic, mm-hmm. being more associated with the dopamine reward pathways.
Yep. Perfect. So yeah, the corticolimbic, I think, in addition to sort of serotonin being the neurotransmitter we talk a lot about in depression because that's what a lot of our drugs treat for, it also covers that sort of emotional learning, salience, importance, what we sort of think about as important, what we attach emotional significance to, and therefore like that's how it's thought to be associated with depression. The other sort of pathway or sort of I guess important thing to know in limbic system is the Papez circuit, which has two pathways, perforin and alveolar. I won't go into any more details, but things to look up and be aware of. The other sort of biological concepts to consider, very briefly, I'll talk about the triple network theory. So this is around the fMRI studies that looked at different sections of the brain and I guess what parts of cognition and learning that they attributed to. So you had the central executive network that's sort of your, you know, executive function, your learning, sort of you're thinking about things. So if you have a new task, that you don't know anything about and you have to learn how to do it, that's the part of the brain that's going to be working really hard. The salience network, which is sort of the area that assigns importance to something, and then the default mode network. So that's sort of where the operations happen. If it's a learned skill, something, learned skill or learned idea that you're familiar with, and that's the part of the brain that tends to be activated. And we know that, well, the theory is much like, I guess, it's sort of the biological version of Beck's, and that there's, if you have abhorrent learning that attributes negative importance to things, then that becomes the default pathway that you use. So if sort of learnt negative association then gets replicated and becomes a sort of vicious cycle. This is all getting a bit dry, isn't it? But there's two more topics. Like it's all important.
No,
and I think
definitely.
And I think particularly for the second years, these are the things that I guess are relevant and will come up for you guys. Mm. They tend to be less clinically relevant.
The neuropsych stuff.
Yeah, the neuropsych stuff. So the last one briefly is the hypothalamic pituitary axis, which is, you know, in really simple terms, it's the stress response. So we know that in mental illness, particularly depression and anxiety, it's overactivated, and that's what caused a lot of the physical symptoms in anxiety and depression. So there's essentially an increase in sympathetic drive from sort of upregulation of corticosteroids, ACTH, mm-hmm. That, you know, causes quite physical symptoms, as well as, you know, the thought is reinforces the psychological symptoms. And the last one, and I sort of did it in opposite order to how I wrote it, because I thought, this gets onto a little bit in terms of treatment, so it's probably relevant to put last, is that we talk about the monoamine theory of depression, which is, I think I said at the start, it's one of the ideas that really came about because of the treatments that were developed and how they worked. So I guess the theory is that depression can be attributed to a reduction in the availability of neurotransmitters, particularly serotonin, and that sort of reduces the emotional response in people with depression. And I guess that was attributed by the use of various drugs, starting with monoamine oxidase inhibitors, then tricyclic antidepressants, and then eventually SSRIs or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And I guess knowing that these drugs work, so I'll talk about SSRIs because they're the ones that we generally use most now, is that if you increase the available amount of serotonin, you can reduce depressive symptoms. So they are reuptake inhibitors. So at the neuron, serotonin gets reabsorbed. If you inhibit that process, you increase the amount of serotonin that sits there in the neuron space and therefore is available to be used, and essentially artificially increase the amount of serotonin that someone has available. So I've sort of answered the question a little bit myself, but what's the first line treatment for someone with a true clinical depression or a major depressive disorder?
SSRIs.
Yeah. So can you name a couple?
Fluoxetine.
Yep, fluoxetine's a good one.
Escitalopram.
Yep.
That's the two I got.
Yeah.
Sertraline's the other one
that's
used a lot. Probably one of the oldest ones. There's lots of new ones. Fluvoxamine, as I said, escitalopram, citalopram, and probably several others, but none that I use a lot. There's a few other different medications that you use. We talked a little about tricyclic antidepressants, tetracyclics, mirtazapine being the main one that you see used, but certainly SSRIs tend to be the first line. there's one population that that's generally different.
Yeah, we discussed this before. We're not 100% sure. Why don't you give us a hint?
So the hint is where I work at the moment.
Yeah, so I was thinking in pregnant women because you're working children, so then with children. And then we were sort of saying as well, maybe first trimester of pregnancy being a bit more cautious.
All really good points. I mean, the angle I was gunning for was kids. So we tend not to use antidepressants in kids as a first step as often. And I guess that's because that, mental illness presents very differently, and it's less easy to say that, a child actually has true depression. And also because obviously all of the studies are done in adults.
Yeah.
And there's not really a lot of evidence for antidepressant use in, empirical evidence for antidepressant use in people under the age of 18. That being said, if you have to use one, obviously you can. The preference is fluoxetine because that has the most evidence and tends to be the most well tolerated. But generally, you try and do other things first.
Yeah.
I'd agree. So the first trimester pregnancy, obviously being cautious. The medication of choice if you need to in pregnancy and breastfeeding is sertraline.
Mm-hmm.
Tends to be the most well tolerated, has the least risk of causing fetal deficits, and it's the sort of least risk to the child in breastfeeding as well. I guess the alternative is psychotherapy, and that's what we use in kids first. So cognitive behavioral therapy generally being the first line, but lots of other psychotherapies can be used for depression. So that's sort of, I guess, a lot of theory and a lot of neuropsychiatry and information. But if we get a little bit back to the case, there's something that we mentioned on the end of Dig Spaces that is very important. And that's asking about suicidality and suicide risk. So there's another very useful acronym that exists, and I know it certainly even registrars, and it's one that I've used as well even today, just to make sure that you're ticking all the boxes and screening as best you can for risk. And that's sad persons.
Sad persons.
Yep.
Run through it.
Let's run through that one as well.
All right.
Bit of alternating action.
Yeah, we'll do some alternating. S for sex. So in particular, I think there's a high risk in males of suicide.
And then A for age, being younger males.
Younger and older. So bimodal.
Bimodal, yeah.
Yeah.
What about in women? Do we see any changes in distribution across ages?
I think age, the sort of age evidence wasn't sex specific, but I guess it is that bimodal peak is seen more in men. I think if you looked at the evidence, you'd probably see a slightly increased risk in middle-aged women as opposed to the sort of the tops and tails. But certainly in the population as a whole, it's the younger group that's the most at risk.
The D in sad persons with depression, obviously, in this case.
And then the P for psychiatric history. So in particular, looking for past suicidal attempts, which will increase your risk.
Yep.
E for excessive drug use. So this can include recreational drugs, prescription drugs, alcohol, anything.
R for rationality loss. And
So, I mean, that's one of those ones that you're like, they've tried to make it fit in the acronym. But I think it raises a key point in that, you're looking for someone that isn't thinking clearly about things. And the big one there is that they're hopeless. So there's lots of studies that have been done to try and look at suicide risk assessments and make it evidence-based, but it's a little bit futile. We don't really know. But one thing that does come up that we know does increase the risk is, is hopelessness.
Mm.
Yeah. Does that sort of also, in terms of looking at a history of suicidality or suicidal ideation, tie in with when you're looking for protective factors?
Yeah. So, if someone's saying they're hopeless and there's nothing good in the world and things that they used to, they used to find protective, like their family or their children or their partner, now they're saying, well, it doesn't matter. They'll be fine without me. They're better off anyway. There's no hope for me. It doesn't really matter. Then that's certainly more worrying than someone that, says, oh, I feel really bad, but I know that I've got people that care about me and there are positives in my life.
Or like the things that stopped you from the attempt that happened.
I guess that's a good segue to the next S, which is separated. So in particular, talking about separation within a relationship.
Yep.
And then O being for organized plan. And so it's really important to look at the plans that someone's had and then see how systematized they are and looking at the lethality of those plans as well.
N for no supports. So we're looking at, what social supports this person has, whether it's family, friends, or whoever else.
Yep.
Them.
And S for sick. Or chronic illness.
Yep. And that's
the thing. That's the acronym.
That's a really good, obviously it doesn't encompass everything or, and all things that might increase someone's risk, but it's a really good framework to sort of look at the main things we know that can contribute to someone's risk of suicide. The most important thing is to ask. So there used to be this idea that, oh, if you ask, you might put the idea in someone's head, but we certainly know that that's not the case. And if you don't ask, you don't know. And I think being able to talk about it is often very helpful, in the people that have these thoughts but aren't particularly high risk. I think being able to talk someone through and rationalize it with someone can in itself be therapeutic.
Yeah. Simo, do you think you could maybe talk a bit about, I know it can be daunting sometimes to approach this history when you're first starting and you haven't taken a psychiatric history before. Can you give us sort of
tips
or, you know, a nice phrase that you can say, or things that could be helpful for people that haven't taken a suicide history before?
Yeah, I guess it's one of those things that can be a bit confronting. It can be a bit hard, and certainly it's not the first thing you ask. You do want to sort of warm into a bit of a history first. But I guess once you've already asked a lot of the other, you know, in someone that's coming to you feeling depressed, it's something that they're, you know, in most cases, they're expecting that you're going to ask about it. And particularly if they've already had these thoughts, they're expecting that there's something you're going to ask about. If you've gone through your depression history, you're sort of already in that mindset that you're talking about those things. And then I just simply ask, you know, have things ever been so bad that you've thought about ending your life? And then you can, you know, if they say yes, and you can sort of flesh it out from there, you know, how often do you think about it? Tell me about what some of those thoughts are like. Have you ever got further than thoughts? Have you made any plans? And if so, what stopped you doing anything about it now? What are the things that keep you going? And, you know, in that way, you can get, you know, some of that information out to sort of get an idea of, you know, what the severity of these thoughts and the severity of the risk that they have of enacting them. It's a really important part of your assessment, and I think it's something that you shouldn't be afraid to ask. And as I said, a lot of the time they're expecting it to be asked. And if, as long as you've sort of been able to build a bit of rapport in the rest of your interview, and you sort of have been able to get to a point where they're open and talking about other things, it shouldn't be generally something that you're met with too much resistance. And if it is, and if there's someone that then becomes quite guarded, then that sort of in itself, you know, for me is a bit concerning and makes me think a bit more about asking the questions. And then it might just be a case of, you know, again, trying to build a bit rapport, asking a few other things first and then getting back to it. But certainly if you've got someone that's a bit guarded and doesn't want to talk about it, and that's not enough just to leave it lie, you really have to get enough information that you feel comfortable and knowing, you know, in yourself, you know, how risky this person is. I guess that leads on to sort of talking about, I guess, containing risk and what to do if you're worried about someone. And obviously, you know, being high risk of suicide is a reasonable part of the criteria for, you know, being admitted to hospital into a mental health unit. And that in most cases is hopefully done on a voluntary basis. So you get, you know, get to a point where the person agrees that they're unwell and they need to come into hospital and have treatment for their depression. But in some cases, that's not how it goes. You get someone that is quite guarded, or just is so severely depressed that they really do want to die and they don't want to come to hospital because as far as they're concerned, there's no point. And they just want to go home so they can complete their plan. And when that happens, we have, you know, mechanisms within the Mental Health Act to keep people safe. So there's two main things. So there's care and control, or section 56, 57, which is mainly used by police, ambulance and the ED departments. And that really is just, you can detain someone without their consent for an assessment. So the function of that in the Act is so that they can have a mental health assessment. You can't treat someone for a mental illness under that. You can treat them with medications if they need them, so you can facilitate the assessment. So sometimes we'll use things like benzodiazepines or low-dose antipsychotics to sort of calm, enable people to be calm and engaged in an assessment, but you couldn't start someone on an antidepressant under that part of the Act. And the other part is an inpatient treatment order, which allows treatment against someone's consent for a mental illness, providing that you can prove they have a mental illness, that they have impaired capacity or impaired judgment, that there's no lesser means of treating, less restrictive means, so, you know, they're not willing to do it themselves, and that there's imminent risk to them or others if you don't detain them or treat them. So it's not just about suicidality. I think important thing to consider is risk to others as well. So, I mean, it's less so in the depressive population, something you more consider when you're sort of talking about people that present with psychosis or other behavioral disturbances, but thinking about harm to others. And I sort of blanket rule, I'll ask everyone about firearms. And I think for clinical practice and for OSCEs, that's a good thing to do.
Big OSCE tip.
It's a big tick.
And that's also another notifiable thing, which I think it didn't really get mentioned to us in preclin, and then they randomly started talking about it at the start of our psych term this year.
Yeah. So
which it seems obvious when you say it.
Yeah. So I mean, there is a, I think it's on, you can just Google firearms notification. If you're concerned about someone's risk to themselves or others, you can put in a notification that will, particularly if they've told you they have a firearm, but also if you know, they said they haven't, you can still put one in, and it just flags to the police that this is someone that's at risk. So if they do have a firearm or they apply for a firearm, that sort of gets flagged, and then the police will make a decision as to whether or not they can get a license for that firearm or not. I guess getting a bit on, but we'll just cover other elements of a history broadly that you should think about. So we touched on it a bit before. Yeah, sorry.
No, I was just going to ask, could you summarize sort of the main elements that you'd want to ask on a risk assessment? Because I feel like it comes up a lot in our OSCEs and things like that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, the risk assessment is sort of specific to suicide or harm to self or others, vulnerability. And sort of when I'm doing risk assessment, I generally sort of comment a little bit on all those bits and pieces. But I guess the broad principles, and we use suicide as an example. So I look at static factors that I know will increase their risk. So, that's a lot of the sad person stuff. So they're a young male, they have a known history of depression, they've had attempts before,
yeah.
Or they've self-harmed before. Then sort of look at more dynamic things. So things that are happening now that increase their risk or mitigate their risk. So, current plans or intent, current feelings of depression, hopelessness, current stressors. So have they just lost their job, lost their relationship, been in a big fight, come off the antidepressant. Future risk things. So, is that situation resolving? Have they got known future stresses that are coming up? Are they going to be doing things that will inherently increase their risk? So, things like, using drugs or alcohol. And then the last bit is looking at protective factors. So all this is increasing their risk. What are the things that are sort of mitigating that risk? So do they have a treatment team, psychologist, GP, community mental health team? Are they engaging with that treatment? Do they have social supports that they're engaged with and find helpful at this point in time? And sort of other elements that they find, are there other things that they're still finding positive to try and then I guess weighing up those two. And it's not that there is no right or wrong way about it, but I think that gives you a quite a broad perspective of the person and the risk of, in this instance, suicide occurring.
It's a good framework.
Yeah.
But I guess the other element that we sort of talked about in talking about ITOs is that do they have capacity? So that's sort of the big thing. Are they someone that's aware of what they're doing, and are they someone that's making rational decisions? And that tends to be the make or break thing when you're deciding whether or not to use the Mental Health Act.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a requirement of the Mental Health Act, but that tends to be the one that it really weighs up that decision, because if they've got all of this happening and they're really not thinking right, they're not making decisions, they don't have a lot of insight into what's going on, then that really increases their risk.
Yeah. Sorry for interrupting you.
No, that's okay. I guess this is all realistically all falls in the banner of the history of presenting complaint.
Yeah.
So wanting to think about the other components of a psychiatry history. So very briefly looking at their personal psychiatric history, their family history, particularly of psychiatric illness, developmental history. So how did they grow up? What was life like? What current social supports do they have now?
Mm-hmm.
If we sort of take my sort of fake case, he hasn't had any previous psychiatric presentations, but he's got a mother who has severe depression and has had admissions before, and has had to have electroconvulsive therapy. His maternal grandfather committed suicide. There's no history of bipolar. Developmentally, sort of got quite limited social supports. He's in this very competitive, toxic work environment. His girlfriend's about the only support, and that's a little bit tenuous at the moment. His dad was very authoritarian, very sort of high expectations. Mm-hmm. His mom was a little bit helicoptery and sort of, I guess, covered him in cotton wool. So you could conceptualize that he, has a bit of a strange idea of emotional resilience. It all adds to the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what that brings me to is, the expectations and looking at what at different levels of your time in med school are you expected to know and cover? So for the second years, this is your first entry into psychiatry and mental health with this depression case. And I guess the main themes are recognizing the impact of acute and chronic illness on development of mood disorders, and highlighting that myocardial infarction that just in itself has an increased risk of depression. Mm-hmm. And therefore inviting you to consider sort of acute and underlying factors that contribute to mental illness, sort of establishing a basic understanding of what major depressive disorder is, and what are some of the treatments for it, being able to take a basic history and do a basic risk assessment around suicidality for year four and by extension year five. It's sort of looking at a more broader comprehensive history, being able to get enough information that you can get a little bit more of a robust formulation. So that's looking at that biopsychosocial factors. So not just this man has clinical symptoms of depression that tick all the DSM-5 boxes, but incorporating some of that background history into it and saying, look, well, he's presenting at this time because he's lost his job. Mm-hmm. And that sort of reactivated this theory of his identity that is dependent on who he thinks he is, and it's imposed by this authoritative father that thinks he's no good. He's sort of not able to really regulate because he doesn't have a social structure around him, and he's got quite a biological imprint for depression because he's got that strong family history. And it's sort of being able to incorporate all of those into your understanding of this is a depression case, and therefore looking at what treatments are going to be helpful for this person. So obviously you'd look at this man who has quite a significant depression. He's got quite a strong biological history of depression, which would make you think that a biological treatment is going to be helpful. So you'd be starting an SSRI. And then if you look at the fact that his presentation now is largely driven by a lot of stress and the cognitions that are formed from that stress, he'd certainly be someone that would benefit from a bit of psychotherapy in addition to the medication. And if possible, you'd look to address social things. So, now that he's working less, is he financially safe? What could you do about his social supports? Is there ways that you can get him to reconnect with some of his friends, or will have other social supports around him? Is there a role for family, and how can you sort of build a network around him that will support his recovery? I guess that then extends in for the 6 years, in that you sort of need that. But it's also a bit about considering differentials, considering risk assessments. Because the main place you're going to encounter these people, unless you do a psychiatry term in your internship, is when you're doing your ED term. Mm-hmm. And it's looking at sort of being able to get enough of a history that you can refer to mental health or not refer. You can know when a person needs to be under an ITO or a care and control, and start to think about that disposition and sort of the appropriate pathways for referral. So who's the person that needs to come into hospital versus who's the person that can probably go home, see their GP and get a psychology
and referral. Follow up and
talking a bit about differentials. So we mentioned adjustment disorder with depressed mood. So essentially, I won't go through all the DSM criteria, but has very similar features to depression, but tends to occur around a significant event. So loss of job, loss of relationship, and tends to be limited to within 6 months of that occurring is the DSM cutoff. The clinical or sort of real life implication of that is more about severity, I think, than necessarily the time course. I would still diagnose someone with a major depressive disorder, even if, like in this guy, it's still within that 6 month window. But he's got quite significant symptoms and quite significant impairment in his functioning.
Is that more around that loss of function?
Yeah. And I think that's the really important part to consider in, and set it right at the start in diagnosing a depression is very much about what impact has it had. And there's a caveat in all of the DSM criteria is that it
the functional impairs
function in some way. For 40s and above, should be considering other mood disorders, particularly bipolar. So screening for manic symptoms. So have they had periods of euphoria? Have they sort of done a lot of risk-taking things? Have they had any sort of bizarre or grandiose ideas and been up all night sort of planning how they're going to take over the Freemasons and solve the South Australian tax crisis?
DIGFAST is a good acronym for that one.
For another podcast.
For another podcast, yes.
You can have depression with psychotic features. And I guess you can also have people that present seemingly depressed that have prodromal features of an underlying psychotic illness later on. Mm-hmm. People can present with symptoms of depression that also have a personality disorder, and that tends to be more sort of enduring pattern.
Yeah.
It's less of an episodic acute occurrence of symptoms that now sort of form an episode, but rather they've had a lot of these symptoms for a lot of their life that wax and wane throughout their time. And then I think I mentioned it when we're talking about dig spaces, that there's older population as well, and obviously delirium dementia should be considered in your differentials when looking at depression in the older person.
The 3Ds.
The 3Ds.
Like, is it third year that do?
Yeah, third year does them, and then
Jerry's obviously.
Jerry's in fifth year, and I feel like this is all very relevant for all of the years, which is really good.
And I guess in that's where your cognition comes into play when you know. Are they actually, do they have a cognitive impairment, or is have they got acute cognitive symptoms related to a depression? And trying to nut that out. Are they delirious? Are they actually orientated? Does that cognition wax and wane?
Mm.
And do they have periods of lucidity, or are they, you know, impaired throughout?
Yeah.
Or it's sundowning.
Yeah. So I guess that's a real...
That's depression.
...cook store of depression. I guess what... I'd like to talk about briefly is just general tips in psychiatry and taking histories from people when sort of thinking about mental illness. And I think the most important one of that is sort of just having genuine empathic curiosity, and it goes a long way. You know, like in all medicine, people are coming to you in sort of their moment of need and when they feel their worst, and trying to just understand them is honestly the best thing both therapeutically and diagnostically you can do. So I tend to talk a lot to people about their life in general before I actually ask any questions about symptoms of depression. And that helps me to get an understanding of, I guess, who they are, what they've got around them, and how that's, you know, contributing to why they're here in front of me now. Mm. And I guess it's one of those fields, I think, that often like to take, you know, figuratively, take off the white coat and sort of be less of I'm sort of a knowledgeable doctor person, but rather I'm a person.
Yeah.
I have struggles, you have struggles, let's talk about that.
Let's chat.
And tends to I think work really well and creates that level playing field. Obviously it doesn't work with everyone. There's lots of people that come expecting you to be the expert and the doctor, but I think in sort of getting on a level and understanding people in sort of periods of crisis, I think that's a really helpful technique to use. And the last point is to, I guess, think about, particularly for the 6 years and going into ED when you will see these people in crisis and see people that are acutely suicidal, is to always share the risk, talk to your seniors, get advice, refer. You know, the worst thing that can happen is someone more senior than you telling you that in their opinion everything is okay, and you know, thank you for referring, or thank you for asking the question. Shouldn't ever feel that you should take all of this on yourself. And if you're worried about someone, I think it's important that you as a clinician make that known, because everyone's got an understanding of, you know, by the end of your medical career, you'll have an understanding of this. And obviously if you're like me and you're really interested, you'll have a you know, real keen interest, and that'll help with the understanding. But I think everyone as a clinician has their own sort of gut instinct as to what's concerning and what's not. And often that's more helpful than any sort of tick box criteria you can find. Ask the questions, ask for advice, and talk to your seniors is always really important.
Amazing.
And last thing is look after yourselves. Mm-hmm. So medicine's very stressful, but there's always help there if you need it. We talked a bit about right at the start, sort of mentioned Doctors Health SA, which is a great resource. Get your own GP if you can, but if you don't have a regular GP, they do lots of after-hour sessions, they do long appointments, and they run a very good service. Talk to your mates. Never feel you can't reach out if you feel you need to.
Thank you so much.
Very Simo. Wise words.
Wise so, words from
wise the teaching. Wise words.
Thank you so
no,
much.
You're most welcome, mate.
For coming on today, teaching us all the things. We really, really appreciate it. Hope you're prepared, because I think you're going to get a lot of autograph requests now. We're quite a famous show here. But
wear your face to the promo.
Yeah.
Perfect.
No, we gotta take a picture.
Oh,
it'll be great.
We'll take a picture. All right, well, that wraps up Ed. We'll catch you on the other side. That brings us to the end of Catch Up with the AMSS. Thank you so much for taking the time to come onto our famous you actually wrote famous show today.
Yes, it's famous.
But
thank you as always to our major sponsors, Mega Perks and AMA, for your ongoing support.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.